funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can art help us to understand about ourselves, and what is the value of the persistent and challenging questions it poses? Glenn Ligon's career as an artist took off in 1989 when a direct grant from the National Endowment for the Arts allowed him to quit his day job as a legal copy editor and focus full-time on painted multimedia and video artworks. He is best known for exploring themes of sexual and racial identity, but his work extends also into history, literature, and universal questions about what it means for any of us to simultaneously be part of a dominant culture and also outside it. A major exhibition of Ligon's work called America opens this Saturday, February 12th, and runs through June 9th at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Arriving here after exhibitions in New York and Los Angeles, he joins us now to talk about his work. Glenn Ligon, welcome to THINK.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So since we have this gigantic phrase, mid-career retrospective, I want to start by asking you what mid-career means to you personally.
Well, the exhibition has 25 years of work, and I am 51, so it is literally mid-career to this point. But mid-career means that it's sort of a way of gathering up work over a long period of time and sort of assessing what an artist has done, as opposed to a project, say, that would be more recent work or looking at one specific body of work from the past. It's really about gathering up this 25 years of work and selecting out certain bodies of work that are representative of particular moments in my artistic trajectory.
So what's your role in curating this and deciding things? Were there pieces that others didn't think of that you thought, that really actually represents an important period in my development?
The curator of the show, Scott Rothkopf, and I had a relationship through writing, actually. Mm-hmm. He was an editor at Artform magazine, and so I'd written a couple of articles which he had edited. So when he became curator of the Whitney Museum, we'd already had this way of working together. And that made the show very interesting because we could argue. Mm-hmm. And the discussion about which works would go in the show and which works wouldn't go in the show was really a very intense, engaged one that we had over a long period of time. And what was interesting to me was there were early works that I thought, no, this can't go in the show. I have, you know, an artist always has a certain kind of story that they think they want to tell. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that my dialogue with Scott brought out was that it would be more interesting to expand that story that I imagine about my own work.
So edit it less.
Edit it less. Mm-hmm. You know, include work that's very early as opposed to starting at a specific point. You know, there's the earliest work in the show were things that I did when I was 25 years old. So I thought, well, these, you know, my juvenilia, who needs to say that? But in the context of the exhibition, they show a sort of very interesting transition from very painterly abstract work to text-based work. And so I think that was an important addition to the show. But it's something Scott, the curator, really pushed for and something I resisted but came around to.
So much of what you do involves text. And I'm curious as to, for you, where the balance is and how you sort of make decisions regarding simply the form of the piece as compared with the context of the piece. And maybe to you as an artist, they're not so separate from each other.
They're pretty close together. I don't ever read something to find a text for artwork. Mm-hmm. I just read to read.
Yeah.
And the text that I use in the artworks come from things that have just stayed in my head over time. And usually it takes a couple of years to find a form for that work. So when I first started doing paintings with text in them, I tried to make very clean letters, you know, using letter stencils and make very precise letters. But I was also using oil paint, and it's very difficult to use oil paint and make a very clean line. And then I realized, oh, the form, the messiness of these letters was actually interesting. It was part of the meaning of the work. But that took a long time to figure that out. And mm-hmm. so I think for any artist, it's about finding a form for the things that you're interested in, and that can that takes time.
Yeah. When you talk about time, I'm curious about how much of your work day, work month, work year is really spent just thinking as opposed to being in the studio putting works together.
Well, you know, it's a sort of joke that I make with myself that I've found a profession where I can lie on my couch and still be doing work. But a lot of my time is just thinking about how things appear, you know, how are they going to appear in the world? And a lot of time is spent playing around with materials or formats or getting people into, you know, fellow artists to look at work and say, what do you think? Or just sitting around letting things percolate, you know, and seeing if there's a better solution for the problems that I've set for myself.
When you do find a text that really sticks with you, are you a scrawler in margins? Are you? Is it? Does it tend to always be something that you have memorized because it struck you at the time you read it?
Usually it's something I've memorized. Mm-hmm. Or it's something that I've read over and over again. I keep returning to. There's a body of work in the exhibition, paintings based on an essay by an African-American author, James Baldwin. Mm-hmm. The essay is called Stranger in the Village. And it's something I read in college. And every year or so, I would read it again. But I didn't start making work using that essay until maybe 20 years after I'd actually read it. So it was sort of this kind of percolating thing in my brain that I wanted to, that I knew somehow I wanted to use, but hadn't found the form of.
And this is the essay where Baldwin is in Switzerland and he is the only black person in this village, is that right?
Right, right. And he's writing about the sort of the experience of being, you know, in this, a little Swiss village in the 50s and being the only black person that many of the villagers have seen. But he uses that as a way to think about what does it mean to be a stranger anywhere, you know? But he's also talking about his relationship as an African American to European culture. He talks about Europe's relationship to its colonies in Africa. He talks about the civil rights movement and his sort of exile and alienation from the country of his birth. So it's quite a panoramic essay. It's trying to deal with very complicated, large issues. And that's, I think, why I kept reading it over and over again, because I was attracted to this sort of deep exploration of these issues in the essay.
It's interesting that you describe it that way in particular, because it is clearly about more than simply Baldwin's experience of being black. And,
right.
And certainly your art is about more than that. And yet people will look at it and sort of instantly frame, if they know anything about you, they will frame it in that way, that in the sense that they might not do with a white artist exploring culture and background and history. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think because the history of African Americans in this country is a difficult history, mm-hmm. and it's easier to frame it as something that's over there somehow. That's
for him to explore.
Yeah. Them to deal with. We don't really have to think about it. Mm-hmm. But I remember a McDonald's commercial that was playing in February. It's Black History Month. And at the end of the commercial, which was about, I think, some kind of action figures, Black History action figures you could get with a Happy Meal or something like that. At the end of the commercial, one of the people in the commercial says, it's not Black history, it's American history. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, it's coming from a McDonald's commercial. But in a way, I think that's an important thing to say, mm-hmm. that the experiences of African Americans in this country are not separate, you know. They're not just black history. They're American history. They're what makes this country, you know. This so it's important when you're looking at a work that starts in a specific experience to think about it in a broader way. You know, it's not separate.
You have a sort of iconic work in this show, and that is it's like a coloring book picture of Malcolm X,
right?
And that was taken from a child's rendering of it, is that right?
Right. 1970s era coloring books, which were made with the idea that African-American history was not being taught in schools mm-hmm. in an adequate way. And so this group of educators come up with these coloring books to give to young kids to sort of normalize these images of black heroes. So you'd have an image of a girl combing her hair or a boy swinging on a tire next to an image of Harriet Tubman or Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. So what I did for an exhibition at the Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis was take those 70s-era coloring books and give them to kids 3 and 4 and 5 years old, and they colored them. And then I made paintings that were based on the way they colored those images.
And this one that we're talking about of Malcolm X, it almost looks like he's in drag. He's got lipstick and blue eyeshadow. And why did that one strike you?
Well, because I think it's interesting to me that kids always have this impulse to sort of deface parental figures. You know, that's a common thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting on that level, defacing the image of the father. But it's also interesting to me because it says something about how icons get made over and over from generation to generation. If you think about Malcolm X in the 70s, you know, for many people, he was a very, very dangerous, most dangerous man in America. But now Malcolm X's image is on a postage stamp that you could buy at the post office. And so that tells me a lot about how icons like Malcolm X and their meaning and how they sort of fit into the culture mutates, changes over time. And so part of what that project was using those kids' drawings was about this changeability of these images.
Do you think that evolution of the way someone like Malcolm X is perceived also speaks to a sanitization that's required in order to let these images be fully accepted?
I think so. Things that seem very dangerous at one cultural moment seem very mild at another. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that we see on TV now would shock my parents. If my parents were still alive, they'd be shocked. So I think it is true that the culture, the sort of boundaries of what's deemed acceptable and unacceptable change and shift over time. And there is a sort of sanitizing process that does go on.
Another really interesting series you have is some posters that describe you. You asked your friends to describe you, and they are placed onto these posters that look very much like fugitive slave posters from the antebellum South.
Right.
Talk about what you were thinking about as you went into this and why some of the descriptions are pretty humorous as opposed to things that might be so shocking. And I think that alone is shocking.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I was thinking about was doing a body of work that dealt with slavery, the history of slavery in this country, but not doing it as a way to point to something that happened a long time in the past and needs to be remembered because everyone's forgotten. Because I was really thinking about art installation that I'd seen had dealt with the subject of slavery that always positioned slavery as this event in the past. And I wanted to think about slavery as this problem of American democracy that's there when we're forming our Constitution and our laws. And its effects somehow resonate in the culture today. They can still be felt. And so the idea behind these runaway posters that look like something you would see in the 19th century, these posters describing a runaway slave and inserting myself into that was a way of bringing the sort of past to the present.
Artist Glenn Ligon is my guest. America, his mid-career retrospective exhibition, opens February 12th and runs through early June at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation with Glenn in a couple of minutes, and we have phone lines open now. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can ask your question via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think Gone, KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is artist Glenn Ligon. His exhibition, America, runs February 12th through June 9th at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about this title, America. It's big and it's broad. Is it your America, or is it the America you imagine that we're all experiencing?
Well, I think it's the title came out of thinking about the work and how often the word America appears in texts that I've used, or how often the subject of a text that I've used in a painting is about America. So it seems to, or how often I'm referencing American literature, Walt Whitman, Zora Neale Hurston, James Baldwin. So it seemed to be a kind of thread that ran through lots of different bodies of work. It is an immodest title. You know, it's big and immodest, but it seemed that it kind of encapsulated something about the work that was interesting, you know, this focus on American history.
Talk about the neons that say America that are featured in the show.
Right. There are three neons in the show that use the word America. And in an odd way, they're not about America. I mean, they're about America because they say the word America, but they started out being about me trying to figure out a way to deal with Charles Dickens, mm-hmm. Tale of Two Cities. The beginning of that novel, it's a very famous passage, it says, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And I thought that I was trying to make a piece using that text from Dickens, and I could never figure out exactly what to make. But then I realized that Dickens in that novel is talking about a moment in a society, you know, a moment of incredible optimism, but also of poverty and despair. And I felt that, you know, the first neon that I made that said America was made, I think, 2006, and we were in a war. Mm-hmm. We're still in a war. The economy was booming. So the sort of sense of things were going really well and things weren't going well at all seemed to be where the culture was at that moment. And so I realized that the word America, this sort of flashing sign that says America, going off and on, somehow kind of dark and light at the same time, was a good way to deal with the sense of like where the country was at.
And on any given day, any one of us can be at either of those extremes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about this as an African-American artist and also a gay artist, and your work has dealt with both of these things. You have, on the one hand, these two really rich cultural traditions to draw from, and on the other hand, they are united in some ways by a long legacy of other people deciding who you are supposed to be based on those categories.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't, you know, I don't have separate areas in my studio for gay art or black art. So, you know, I think what's interesting about any person that's making art is they bring the range of their experience to the creation of those works. And so, as you said, I do have very rich traditions to draw on. And I try to use all of those traditions when I'm making a work. So I don't think I separate things out into these categories, but categories are how we understand the world. So mm-hmm. it's easier for someone to say he's a black artist and therefore his work must deal with these issues or look like this, or he's a gay artist and therefore his work looks like this or deals with these issues. But for me, those categories are a bit limiting, and they limit people's ability to be engaged with the work, you know, the categories themselves yeah. limit people's abilities to engage with the work.
So you may be directly dealing with neither of those things in a particular piece, but that frame is overlaying.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
What about when you use a text? I mean, people who know the original work may come into an exhibition with preconceived notions about what it means based on what they know of or believe about the person who said or wrote the quote to begin with.
Right. I think an artwork using a quotation from Gertrude Stein or James Baldwin or Ralph Ellison is sort of like a movie adaptation of a novel, mm-hmm. you know? They're not the same thing. They try to do different things. They have an ideas that come from the original source, but they also try to do different things. And so I think that's kind of how I approach using someone's text. You're not going to go into the show and look at a painting that's using Baldwin's Stranger in a Village and be able to read the entire essay there, or that's not what the paintings are about, mm-hmm. you know. But what the paintings are about, and I think what Baldwin's essay is about kind of density of ideas and the difficulty of translating these very complicated notions about national identity and race and personhood into an essay. Mm-hmm. And me looking at that essay and trying to find a parallel to that in a work of art, you know. And so the difficulty of the text, you know, the legibility of the text in my paintings is about the difficulty and the density of the ideas in the essay. So
why stick mostly with stencils rather than writing in some other form, even using your own hand to convey these messages?
Right. Well, stencils are easy. You can wipe them off and use them again. But also, I'm very influenced by artists who use text, like Jasper Johns. Mm-hmm. And so my use of stencils is, sort of comes out of someone like Jasper Johns. But also, stencils sort of move the text away from a kind of autobiography. If you'd seen the same text written out, you would just assume it was the author of the painting, you know, writing out this text must be the one who wrote it. Mm-hmm. But I think if you see something stenciled, there's a little distance. There's some idea that maybe it's not simply a text that Glenn Ligon has written that he's transferred onto a painting, that maybe there's some other way of thinking about it. So it provides me with a little distance.
So you're challenging us to think about why you chose it and what it meant once it sort of got
right
into your brain.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You also draw from your own life in some of these works. And there are some, I guess, report cards or school reports from when you were a kid. Tell us about those and what they say.
Well, I went to a very I would say overly liberal private school. I grew up in the Bronx in New York, and my mother decided that my brother and I needed to not go to the public school across the street from our house because it wasn't very good. And so she called around and found a school that would give her enough scholarship money to send both me and my brother there. And the school, instead of having grades, had report cards, very lengthy kind of personality analysis kind of report cards that you could do in schools in the 70s, mm-hmm. Which were about kind of how we behaved in school, what our intellectual capabilities are, how I got along with kids in my class, things like that. So they were quite detailed. And so I decided to make a set of prints that just use those report cards. As a lot of my work deals in some ways with questions of autobiography, but it's always autobiography that's one step away from autobiography. Mm-hmm. So these report cards are about me, but they're someone else's take on me, mm-hmm. you know? So I'm always interested in sort of what other people have said and using that as this kind of way of getting at notions of biography or autobiography.
Were there not a lot of other scholarship students in the school?
No, there weren't a lot of other scholarship students in school, but it was an interesting school. I went to school with Mike D from the Beastie Boys and Matthew Broderick, so that it was that kind of school. Mm-hmm. The school was very involved in the civil rights movement. In fact, Andrew Goodman of Goodman, Chain and Sorter, and three civil rights workers who were killed, Andrew Goodman went to my high school. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a progressive school in that sense.
It must have been an interesting place to explore your own identity as well, being different from some of the other students. If by nothing else, certainly there was race, but also just socioeconomic background.
Right. You know, I grew up in a public housing project in the South Bronx, and the school was on the Upper West Side of Manhattan facing Central Park. And many kids in the school lived in very grand apartments facing the park. So there was that transition, from my home life to the school life. But also it was a school that didn't have very many minority kids at the time. This is, I went to that school from the early 70s to the time I graduated from high school. So, there was a lot to deal with, you know.
Yeah. Were you known from the beginning as the kid who's going to be an artist?
No, because I didn't think of myself as the kid that was going to be an artist. That came very late, actually. Actually, it came after college. Mm-hmm. Art always felt like something I was interested in. It was something my parents encouraged because they thought that learning about art was the thing that a sort of educated person in the society should know about. So they sent me to pottery classes and after-school drawing classes at the Metropolitan Museum. But my parents never thought that I was going to be an artist. My mother said the only artists she'd ever heard of were dead. And she meant Picasso. She'd heard of Picasso, but it just wasn't in her vocabulary. Mm-hmm. She didn't know anyone who was an artist. And so she was worried for my future. So I really thought I was going to go to architecture school. And that was sort of what I was pursuing in school. But then I realized that I was really much more interested in art. And that's where my talents lay. And I kept going in that direction.
Did you ever think about writing as a career, given your passion for the power of language?
I have written, but I don't think that I have the discipline to be a writer. I need to move around. Writers sit at their desk a lot, and I need to move around more. And actually, I find that writing is as hard as making artwork. Mm-hmm. And if given the choice, I'd rather be in the studio making artwork.
Do you typically work by yourself? Do you have a lot of assistance with you? How does your if you're actually working on a piece?
Mostly I work by myself. Now I have a couple of people who work with me because there are lots of different kinds of projects going on. I'm doing a commission for a school and it's going to be a very large neon piece. So I have some fabricators I'm working with. As I branch out into sort of other directions besides painting, I find it more and more interesting to work with other people, or more and more necessary, actually.
My guest is artist Glenn Ligon. His mid-career retrospective, America, runs February 12th through June 3rd at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Ron, who says, tell us how you interact with other artists. It came out last night at The Modern that so much of your work is based on what other artists have done. The names of Bruce Nahum and de Kooning and many other writers came up. And I may be mispronouncing these. De Kooning and other writers came up. And yet I heard you say you seek feedback from other artists. Perhaps you can elaborate.
Right. Well, I'm looking at art all the time. Artists that you mentioned, like de Kooning, who is a big hero of mine, the abstract expressionist painter. And then more contemporary artists, Bruce Nahum, Kara Walker, Jean-Michel Basquiat. But I also have a community of artist friends around, and the studio building that I'm in has lots and lots of artists, and a lot of them I know. And so sometimes I just get stuck, mm-hmm. and I just go down the hall and go to, say, my friend Byron Kim, who's a painter, and drag him into my studio. And we have a joke. We call it the 5-minute crit, where I drag him in and say, okay, is that any good? Is that any good? And, you know, sort of have a dialogue about painting. And then he goes back to his studio, goes back to work. So it's very nice to have this sort of community of people around to bounce ideas off of.
What sort of critic would you say you are when your friends seek your counsel on their work? Do you just get right down there? Are you really careful to couch your words?
I'm pretty tough, mm-hmm. Because the friends who ask me to critique their work are pretty good. So they can stand someone to, you know, being tough with them, you know, because they know it's in service of making better work, you know. And I want those friends to be tough with me, too, you know.
Does everything you do end up being finished and put out there for sale or for exhibition?
No, half the stuff I do ends up in the dumpster. That's an artist's process, mm-hmm. you know, self-editing, mm-hmm. I think, which is very important.
How do you, I mean, is it painful to let something go or does it feel great? Like I'm going to leave this behind.
Sometimes I'm a little too harsh. Sometimes I've meant to throw something out and just got put on a shelf somewhere, and I'll pull it out, you know, 3 years later when cleaning out the studio. And what was wrong with that? That's pretty good. So I know sometimes I'm too tough. But no, I think when you throw things out, it makes room for other things to come in, you know.
Another work that I understand is in the show is based on this historical story of an enslaved man who had himself mailed to freedom. Can you tell us about that?
Right. It's a narrative by Henry Box Brown. He was a slave in Richmond, Virginia, and sort of got a brilliant idea to have a crate made by a white carpenter who was sympathetic to anti-slavery causes. He was nailed inside of this crate and taken to the post office and mailed to an anti-slavery society in Philadelphia. And so he was in this box for, I think it was about 25 hours. Mm-hmm. And then after he was liberated, he wrote a narrative about his time being a slave and his escape. And I was very curious about that narrative and very curious about this image that I'd seen of Henry Box Brown being liberated from the box. And so the exhibition contains an installation that is based on a crate that is in the proportions of the crate he was shipped in. And that crate has soundtracks running in it, Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, me reading Henry Box Brown's narrative. And around the walls of that room are a set of prints called The Runaways, which are descriptions of me as if I had gone missing and needed to be described to the police and set into this format that looks like 19th century runaway slave posters. And then another set of prints called The Narratives, which are bits and pieces of slave narratives that I've made into an autobiographical component for the show.
Glenn Ligon is my guest. His mid-career retrospective exhibition, America, runs February 12th through June 3rd at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. We'll come back to our conversation in a moment. You can get to us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is artist Glenn Ligon. You can see his mid-career retrospective exhibition, America, opening February 12th through June 3rd at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I know that you have a painting hanging in the private quarters of the Obama family right now in the White House. First of all, if you could have chosen any painting, is that the one that you'd want them to take?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I think that that painting appealed to the Obamas because it deals with American history. It's called Black Lightning Number 2, and the text is from a reporter named John Howard Griffin, a local guy, who went, he's white, he went south with darkened skin in the 50s to report on what it would be like to, what it was like at the time to be an African American, and wrote this very famous book called Black Like Me. And I think the sort of engagement with the history of the South, the sort of sense of finding out about the other, you know, sort of transcending one's own experience and trying to sort of learn what it's like to be another was something that, I mean, I haven't talked to the president about this, so I don't know, but I imagine that appealed to him. But I think, what else would I have chosen for them? I don't know. Interesting question.
It might be too much of a burden to have to pick, right?
But I'm thrilled that we have a president and first lady that believe in culture. Mm-hmm. We're not scared of art. I just saw an image of them recently going to see a modern art exhibition at the Corcoran in Washington, D.C. And I think that sends a really great message that culture is part of what we do, mm-hmm. you know, as Americans. And the president and the first lady and their daughters going to see contemporary art, I think, is encouraging.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Penny in Dallas. Hello, Penny.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Good. This is a great conversation. I didn't get to hear Glenn last night at the Modern, but I wish I had. And my question was that as a he's talked some about his experience as a black man in America. As a gay man in America, does the issue of AIDS enter into any of his work?
Thanks for your call.
There is one piece in the exhibition called Notes on the Margin of the Black Book that is an investigation of the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe's images of black men. And some of the quotes in that piece deal with questions of AIDS. But I think that may be the only work that deals directly with it.
Choosing Mapplethorpe is always interesting because people feel so very strongly about his work one way or another. Talk about the extent to which that was in your mind as you made that the source for this further exploration.
Right. Well, in the 80s, Robert Mapplethorpe's photographs were subject of much debate, whether federal funds should go for an exhibition that was organized around Mapplethorpe's work, because some of the images in Mapplethorpe's work were considered pornographic or sadomasochistic. And so there's a huge debate around, you know, this exhibition. But I was interested in his photographs of black men and dealing with some of the issues around those photographs. But I didn't want to go around with a little stamp saying, this is a good image, this is a bad image, this image is racist, this image is not racist.
We should say Mapplethorpe was not black.
But Mapplethorpe was not black. And so the piece became about all these various voices on the photographs, you know, gathering together 78 quotes that represent a range of voices about the issues around these photographs of black men. And letting the viewer sort through them, basically.
And they don't necessarily correspond directly. It's not like right below this image is the placard that will sort of talk about the picture you're seeing.
Right. The piece really is, in a way, making a space for a public forum. So I didn't want to caption the photographs. Mm-hmm. I wanted the text that comments on the photographs to run independently so that if you look at the piece, you can just look at the photographs, mm-hmm. and they're beautiful photographs. Or you can look at the piece and read the text and sort of think about the photographs within the space of the sort of questions and debates around them. And that's the kind of space that I think art can open up, you know, space for debate and questioning and thinking.
Are there particular ideas that you instantly associate with particular media that you've worked in?
Let me think about that. I think, you know, when I work in paint, I'm always thinking about my beginnings as an abstract painter. Mm-hmm. And so even though the paintings use text from essays, they still operate as abstract paintings for me. The things that I'm thinking about in the back of my mind are abstract painting formal issues, mm-hmm. you know, density of the paint, surface, color, things like that. So it's interesting to me that paintings want to be paintings for me. They don't want to be other things, you know.
And then you've also worked in video, is that right?
I've done two videos. One was a collaboration with jazz pianist Jason Moran. That was a video called The Death of Tom. Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be about the last couple of minutes of Thomas Edison's version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, his film version. But when we were shooting the film didn't come out. But then I got very interested in this sort of play of light and shadows of the sort of ruined film. And so I asked Jason Moran if he would score it. So basically, we have a very abstract film scored by this brilliant pianist that somehow, you know, in its abstractness, gets at this sort of idea of Uncle Tom, you know, and his death at the last scene of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
I read a really interesting, it's available online, I guess you two interviewed each other or spoke to one another, and this has been, the conversation has been reproduced, and it was very interesting to see what each of you sort of understood innately about one another's approach to the project.
Right. Well, Jason, I think, is a brilliant collaborator with visual artists, and he's done a number of pieces with artists like Joan Jonas or Adrian Piper or Kara Walker, and he just gets what you're trying to do, you know, and is very able to translate his ideas to other medium, you know. So it was an incredible pleasure to work with him.
We have an email here from Judy in Arlington who wants to know if there is any work of art that you have done that you regret doing.
Oh, really interesting question. Well, there were works of art I regret doing because they probably just weren't very good. So I regret that I let them out of my studio. I don't think there's any work of art that I have regretted in that sense. So I feel like there are probably works of art that I felt like I hadn't dived deeply enough into the subject matter. Mm-hmm. Which is a bit different than the sort of regret that it's out in the world,
yeah,
but more just that, no, I could have gone further with that. But then I think, you know, artists make another body of work, mm-hmm, you know, in order to go further. You know, once a piece, you think a piece is done and it goes out into the world, you can't sort of bring it back, but you can maybe think through the ideas more deeply and then another body of work comes out of it.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by when artists are exploring one particular subject or form, or, you know, they will create a series of, at least in visual works, works that seem to resemble one another, but they're all part of a continuum.
Right, right. Because it's a way of thinking through ideas, and sort of these slight changes are just different thoughts.
Yeah.
You know?
So it doesn't mean painting 9 is better than painting 4 necessarily.
No, it's just that painting 9 may give you a different take, you mm-hmm know, a different way of looking at the subject matter. And I think that's always interesting. Yeah.
One of the things you don't have control over, assuming that you release a work for sale, is exactly where it will be and the context in which it is seen. Does that bother you, or do you just have to not think about it?
No, you have to just let things go, mm-hmm, you know. But that's what's nice about this kind of retrospective show, is that I'm essentially visiting things that I haven't seen in a very long time. Some paintings I haven't seen since they were made, so given there's 25 years of work in there, that's, you know, half my life, something has been out of my sight. So it's interesting to see things again.
Have you discovered or recognized things in those early, early works that you hadn't realized were present at the time?
I realized that I'm maybe a better better writer than I thought I was,
mm-hmm,
you know, because, I shouldn't say writer, because there's no text in the pieces that I've actually written, but I'm a better, let's say, better editor, uh-huh, than I thought I was. I'm a better assembler of different kinds of texts than I thought I was. And some of the early work, like the narrative series, I was just reading the text again today and thought, oh, these are actually good. You know, they're well edited. They're well put together. So it's nice to know that, because I always think that I'm not a very good editor of my own work. You know, when I've written things for magazines, say, I definitely know I need an editor. But it was interesting to think about that in space of the artworks, that I could edit them myself.
Yeah. What is your preference in terms of the amount of information that is given to audiences who go to see your work in a gallery or in a museum, even just the little cards? How detailed do you want them to be?
I think they need to be detailed enough to give the viewer a sense of what's going on, a sort of broad outline. But they don't need to explain everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that people sort of walking into museums often don't trust what they think,
yeah.
You know? And the tendency is to over-explain things, to make sure exactly that they know, you know, what this work is about and what the artist meant. But I think a more interesting encounter for a viewer is to puzzle through something, you know? And I think actually, you know, we're at a very good moment to look at art because of Google. There's much more information available about artworks, you know, much more resources for people to go to. So I think that's actually made the job of looking at art easier, because one can just go into a museum and look at a painting and look at its colors and forms and things like that. But it's richer if you know some more about the artist. But that can happen over time. It doesn't have to happen while you're standing in front of the painting, you know.
Talk about the influence that Richard Pryor has had on your career.
Well, Richard Pryor was a guilty pleasure. And my mother said that she wouldn't let me and my brother buy Richard Pryor records because she would say he was too grown for us, you mm-hmm. know, when we
inappropriate
were,
content.
Inappropriate right. content. But we had older cousins, mm-hmm. and the joy of older cousins is that they can sneak you up to their room and put the record player on low, and so we could listen to all these things that we were not supposed to listen to. And Pryor is an interesting comedian for me because he's making jokes, but they're not funny, you know, mm-hmm. because there's such pointed satire of American culture, and he was such a sharp commentator on what America is about, you know, sort of the relationship between the sexes or between the races. So I was always drawn to Pryor as this figure that was, you know, as perceptive about American culture as, say, James Baldwin, you know. They're jokes. And so when I decided to make paintings using Richard Pryor, I knew they had to be in color.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the paintings in the show that use Richard Pryor jokes are some of the most colorful pieces that I've ever done.
I mean, do you find that audiences are comfortable laughing at them, or given their sort of recontextualization, do they take them in a very somber sort of way?
I think audiences have very varied responses to them. I remember a friend telling me about a tour he gave where some of my Richard Pryor paintings were there, and a huge debate breaking out among the audience that he was giving the tour to. One person saying, you know, I came to this museum to see artworks. I didn't come to this museum to see Richard Pryor jokes. And someone else saying, well, don't you like Richard Pryor? I love Richard Pryor at home, but not in the space of the museum. So, and that's one of the things that's interesting to me. What can be said in certain spaces and cannot be said in other spaces? Why is the museum a space where there cannot be a Richard Pryor painting, but you can listen to it at home on your stereo? So I want to collapse those distances.
Glenn Ligon's exhibition America opens this Saturday, February 12th, and runs through June 3rd at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. Glenn, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you. It was fantastic.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.